Well, this is Hear It Now. I'm Bill Thomas sitting in today as host, and Ron Smith is here as well to talk about plants and
trees
and
turf grass and everything else.
Right. Yeah. And warm weather.
Yes.
We've got some really warm weather coming, and that will affect things. Our phone number is 888-755-6377 for your horticultural questions, or you can email your questions to hearitnow@prairiepublic.org. That's hearitnow, H-E-A-R, it now, @prairiepublic.org, or on the phone, 888-755-6377. Now, Ron, I'll have to tell you, after our last show, you may remember we had a caller call in who was concerned about stinging nettles
on
his land.
Right.
And he had little kids, and he was really worried that this would be tough on them. And after the show was over, I got contacted by a woman who actually lives down near the Twin Cities, but she was driving through North Dakota and heard this, and she actually had some advice not for getting rid of stinging nettles, but how to handle the problem when you get stung by a stinging nettle. So I talked to her on the phone, recorded her comments, and we've got them here.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to it.
I was driving home from a job that was in North Dakota that had ended, and I'd heard it. Well, I lived out in the country, and I didn't know what it was that burned so bad, and someone told me it was stinging nettle, burning nettle is also what it's called. And there was this good-sized raspberry patch, and every time I'd go in it, I'd have to just really try to avoid them. And there's also a bunch of burdock, which if you don't know what burdock is, it looks like, the leaves look like rhubarb, and then it's got these really pretty purple things, and then they turn brown, and they turn into burrs, which is why it's called burdock.
Right.
And someone told me that if you take off a leaf and rub it wherever you got burned or stung, that it took it away pretty much immediately, and it does. The other thing is that burdock is invasive, and so is the nettles, but burdock's very, very invasive, and so you want to try and get rid of it if you can, but if you've got stinging nettles, you might want to kind of
preserve a patch of burdock by the nettles if you can't get rid of the nettles. And so you tried it, and it really worked? I mean, did the stinging just, like, go right away, or did it take a while? Or
no, I think it was just about immediate.
Describe, like, how you actually apply it.
You just take the whole leaf, and you, like, wrap it over it like you would with a, you know, a towel or anything, and just rub it up and down or whatever, and it works amazing. And it's painless, and you don't need a prescription. It's free. So it's the right price.
All right.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Amy. And that was Amy. And she had the stinging nettle solution. Just if you can keep them under control and to keep them from taking over everything else, you have some burdock there by the stinging nettles if you can't get rid of them. Because they are pretty hard to get rid of.
Oh,
as we
good
were talking
grief.
About
yes,
that
they time. Are. And that's an excellent tip to have. Because I know there are a lot of people around the state that do have the stinging nettle problem, and they just more or less avoid them rather than try to get in there and get them under control. So, Amy, if you're listening, thank you. if you're not, why, somewhere in the airwaves, your appreciation is being sent out to you.
So there you go. Rub a burdock leaf on the sting, and it goes away. I never knew that. And
I didn't either.
I have been stung a few times, and nobody told me before. Yeah. So next time I'll try that.
Yes, yes.
And burdock is not hard to find around here.
Nope,
so,
nope.
Again, you can call in with your question or email it in by email hearitnow, H-E-A-R-I-T-N-O-W, hearitnow, @prairiepublic.org, or give us a call at 888-75-6377 with your plant, lawn, garden, tree question. We also, after last month's show, we had a lot of kind of the long tail, as they say on the show last week, last month, and we were talking about soil testing, somebody said, what about, this is an email that came in, what about all the other soil nutrients, such as minerals and other nutrients that are not replaced by the NPK fertilizers? Mm-hmm. How do gardeners help to ensure that they are present? Does the testing show any other nutrients, or is there other things that you can do even if you don't test for them?
Yes. Actually, when you have a basic soil test, they're broken down into the major, the secondary, and the minor elements. And the three major elements are N, P, and K, because those are the ones that have the biggest impact and are utilized by plants in their growth cycles. And then you have your secondary ones, which would be calcium, magnesium, sulfur, things like that. That would be your secondary ones, which are important, again, for plant growth. And then you have your minor elements. And the problem with that term minor, people say, oh, it's a minor thing. It's like a scratch.
Uh-huh. It doesn't matter.
Instead of having your arm cut off or something like that, it doesn't matter. But a plant can't grow without it. And many times the minor elements are needed in only small, minute amounts. And if they are missing, you're going to get chlorosis or you're going to get some kind of a deficiency showing up. Like, for example, if you have a shortage of copper in the soil, which is a mineral element, you're going to get shrunken internodes, the distance between your buds being set, and you're going to get rosetting more or less taking place there. If you have a shortage of iron, for example, and I think everybody that knows anything about plants knows this, is you're going to get a chlorosis, a yellowing of the foliage on the new growth with the veins remaining green. And so when we start taking a look at mineral deficiencies or minor element deficiencies, the first one that we take a look at would be iron, because that's the one that's most greatly affected by the typically high pH that we have in our soils around here. So what they'll do, what we'll recommend lots of times is...
The high acidity in the soil oxidizes the iron and then it's not available?
Or? No, the other way around. The high alkalinity.
And
then it's not available. It's there. It's like your coffee in a can, but it's not, you can't get to it. You know, it's there, but you can't get to it. So you have to do something to be able to get to it, and you get a can opener and do the normal procedure.
So if I put a can opener in my garden, that'll solve the iron deficiency.
Yeah.
If it's an iron can opener.
Yeah, it just might, yeah. Yeah. But actually what they do, and there's a word called chelated that's it relates back to some Greek word, and I'm sorry I don't have that on my fingertips right now on the tip of my tongue. But what
it
does,
the word for shell, I think.
Yeah, it holds the iron molecule, which is a trivalent ion, in a form that allows it to be available. And so it's put into the soil, and the pH is not going to complex it. And so the root system then can go ahead and take it up and make it available to the plant, and you eliminate the chlorosis at that point. So, yes, if the N, P, and K, the plants don't respond to the N, P, and K, the pH and the soluble salts, then we take a look at the mineral elements and see what is there. And sometimes, for example, you can have a toxicity there of boron. 1 to 2 parts per million of boron is sufficient. 3 to 4 parts per million of boron could be toxic to particular plants. So it's a very narrow window of need and toxicity. And so it's something that, wow, they've got 8 parts per million or 10 parts per million of boron here. No wonder the things aren't growing well. So that they need to do something to correct that.
Now, for some of these things, can you add, let me again give our phone number if you want to call in with a question for Ron Smith, NDSU Extension Horticulturist. It's 888-755-6377 or by email, hearitnow@prairiepublic.org. Say you have an iron deficiency, can you just take something that's iron and spread it over the soil? Or if you have a calcium deficiency, can you sprinkle eggshells over the soil? Or how do you fix it?
Somebody put you up to these questions, right? It's okay. I enjoy them. It used to be the old-fashioned way. If you had an iron deficiency, you took some iron nails and you drove them into the trunk of the tree. Okay, and that took care of the problem. And that led to a company to come up with a little plug that you can go ahead and drill into the trunk of a tree. And back in the more eastern part of the Midwest in Ohio, there's a very popular tree that's grown. It's called a pin oak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the pin oak is very pH sensitive. And so when what they would do is they'd have this metacaps that you'd go ahead and drill in, and you put it around in a circular way on the trunk of the tree, And of course, the tree would heal over that, and that would correct the iron chlorosis very, very nicely. So, yeah, in some ways, yes, you could go ahead and throw some iron in there if you wanted to drive, get some railroad spikes and drive them to the ground around there. That, I'm sure that was that has been practiced, but the iron would become eventually available.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Yeah. We do have a caller on the line. Michael in Glenburn is on the line. Hello, Michael. What's your question?
Hello. I have a situation in my garden. Back about the 1st of July, I planted on my garden, I planted a bunch of plants, and then I planted a bunch of seeds, a bunch of squash, pumpkins, cucumbers, peas, radishes, beets. Everything that I planted in seed, something came and dug every single seed up, a little bit of the corn, and ate the seed. And in the corn was already starting to grow and ate just the corn seed and left the corn plant. But they've cleaned me out twice now, and I think I know who the culprit is, but I wanted to ask a professional.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of culprits out there that could do that. And depend, where is it you live, Mike?
I live in Glenburn.
Oh, Glenburn. Okay. Is this a rural area?
That you
Yeah. Okay.
West of Glenburn.
Okay. Well, I've seen blackbirds come out into a field, and as the little corn seedlings are starting to show, they come along, they pop the, they use the seedling top as a hook.
A handle.
Handle. Just literally pop, pull it out of the ground, and they eat the seed there. And it then this is poor little thing just starting to come out. They pull them out, eat the seed, pull them out, eat the seed. And that's the way they go after it. So that could be one of the problems. Another one could be raccoons. Okay. They go after seed as well. Could be voles doing something like that, or it could be squirrels. So you've got your choice. I'd like to know which one you think it is.
Well, I think it's the blackbirds or the grackles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grackles, uh-huh. Yeah, I would tend to agree with you because I've seen that. I used to work for a corn farmer out in upstate New York. It was a major sweet corn grower up there, and he'd try to get his corn out as early as he could, and he would get so frustrated when the corn would start to come up that these blasted grackles or blackbirds would get out there and pop out all this corn. So he would go ahead and set up these fireworks along the way to go off intermittently to try to scare them off. And of course, eventually he was able to succeed in doing something like that. And it worked out quite well, but it was just amazing. He just kind of reminds me like my wife that would see the bunny in our garden. He'd get out there and he'd start swearing and go, you know, running across the field and waving his hands or, you know, making a lot of noise to scare the blackbirds off. And, of course, they'd fly off temporarily, and then they'd come back again as soon as he left. And then he'd have to go and get his fireworks rigs set up around the field there to go off intermittently. Over.
So, Michael, are you supplied with fireworks out there?
This is a good time to buy it, yeah.
One sort or another.
Yeah.
It seemed like they just wanted the seeds.
Yeah, so that's right. Mm-hmm.
I've hurried and planted a bunch more in the garage, and as soon as they've came up past the seedlings phase, I'm going to plant them back out in the garden and see what happens. I wonder if you think that might work, because they didn't touch anything in the garden except seeds.
Yeah, that probably would. In fact, I keep quoting my wife, but she's an excellent gardener, and she thinks outside of the box normally. I should say the normal box there of gardening, but she started her corn plants inside and planted them outside.
Really?
Already started, yeah. And then she took a look at the way the sun was hitting the corn, our patch of corn, and she wasn't happy with the fact that one part of it was getting too much shade, so she dug up those corn plants. And they were just about mid-calf high and transplanted them someplace where there was a little bit more sun. So she's kind of a cavalier in her gardening ways, but she's very, very successful, too, in doing stuff like that. So, yeah, give it a try.
All right, Michael. You can transplant them if you
with
don't
care,
know where they are.
The best way to the best time to do that, Mike, is in the evening hours going towards a cooler time when you're not going to have as much stress on the plants being moved into this new environment. Because if you move them out in the morning, like tomorrow morning, I guess it's supposed to be up close to 90 or something like that tomorrow. If you planted them, say, tomorrow morning, and then it got to be 90, 95 in the afternoon, that would be a tremendous stressor on those plants. Whereas if you waited until tomorrow night to plant them, they would at least have 6 to 8, maybe 10 hours 12 hours of relatively cool temperatures to go ahead and get themselves established and hydrate themselves.
Good idea.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks, Michael.
Thanks. Very good call there. Interesting. Thank you.
We have another caller on the line who's been waiting a while, Lopaka from Williston, but maybe we should go to a break first, or we'll go ahead and take this call, I guess. Lopaka, are you there still? Did you stick with us? Hello, Lopaka. Nope, looks like it was too long. Well, maybe Lopaka and Williston will call back.
Okay.
and meanwhile, we've got a short break, and we'll be back after that. The phone number is 888-755-6377 if you have a question for Ron Smith and about garden and lawn and trees and all those kind of plant things. Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with 2 hours of Antiques Roadshow from New Jersey. Then at 9 Central, Monarchy, the Royal Family at Work. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
Nice cello there on
beautiful.
That Disney song.
Yeah,
Under the Sea is where we're not, but we used to be a long time ago. So Peter in Coal Harbor is on the line. We'll get him on, and you can call too. It's 888-755-6377 to talk to Ron Smith about garden issues or other plant issues. And Peter has some thoughts about corn as well. Is that right, Peter?
Yep. I just listened to Michael's call about his trouble with his corn, and we farm corn over here in Coal Harbor, and have been battling the pheasants. And we farm right around Audubon Wildlife Refuge, and so there's lots and lots of pheasants around here, and they'll do the same thing. As soon as the corn gets a couple inches tall, they go through and pull them up and eat the corn, and they'll clear off several acres worth along the field.
Jeez.
And there is a chemical that you can put on the seed that makes it taste bad. I'm not sure what it is. I'm out in the tractor right now, so if I had time to go find out, I could tell you, but you can maybe find it out. But that seems to work when we've done it in the past. You coat the seed with that, you plant it, and when they go along and they dig, when they dig a couple up, it tastes bad, they quit digging them up. And that might work with blackbirds and other critters.
Okay, that's a good tip. I didn't realize such a chemical existed.
That's like sometimes people put hot peppers on things, you know, to make the pests stay away.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, Peter. That's an interesting idea.
Good
All right.
We'll try to find that out. Yeah,
okay.
Thank you for the call.
All right. And I hope it's not too hot out there on that tractor today.
No, I'm in air conditioning, and so it's pretty good.
That's great, good.
Okay. So thanks. We've got another call coming in before we go to that, though, Ron. So you don't know what chemical this is.
I don't know offhand. Maybe we could find out via the internet here if Mick or Skip gets a chance here.
Well, the phone's still ringing.
Yeah.
We've got Marie on the line from Wahpeton. Hi, Marie.
Yes. I planted beets, Harvard beets.
Mm-hmm.
I spaced them so that I would have them separated better.
Mm-hmm.
And three plants came up with each seed. Is that a normal?
Yeah, a beet is a multi-seeded capsule that you get. So go ahead and snip out the least significant of that group that comes up,
and then
you'll have your nice big beets. So
okay, well, so, thank you.
Golf ball size. Yep. Uh-huh. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So every beet mm-hmm. seed you plant, you get multiples.
It's a multiple. I can't think of the term now. I'm sorry. I'm rusty on my basic botany. But
we get the idea, though. I think.
But it's a multiple capsule that you have there, and I'm sure if there's any beet farmers listening, they'll say, "Hey, Smith, this is what it is." You know, yeah. Get your terminology straight. So, if they're out there listening, and they want to correct me, I'll take the correction any day. So,
okay, you can call in either to correct Ron or ask a question. 888-755-6377. 888-755-6377. I think that Skip got some information about that bad-tasting chemical.
Oh, good.
Avapel is a trade name, and anthraquinone is
anthraquinone.
The ingredient.
And what's the trade name?
Avipel.
Adipel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A-V, like victory.
Oh, A-V.
V like?
A-V-I-P-E-L.
Like vile, like it tastes vile.
Ah.
So, okay.
Oh, good. That's good to know.
And just to make those seeds taste bad. Mm-hmm. And I presume it doesn't make the plant taste bad.
You want by the time the corn grows, it's puts on its ear, I'm sure that's long since gone, dissipated. Okay, good. A-V-I-P-E-L. Thanks, Skip.
All right. We have news coming up at the bottom of the hour, but right now on the line from Minot, it's Vicki. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Vic.
Hi. I have a question about a young tree mm-hmm. that we planted a number of years ago. We have planted them and been successful, and this particular one, just, I don't know, it's like if we don't assist it, stake it, it wants to flop over.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something we can do to make it develop some strength?
So it wants to flop over? You mean like it's like the trunk is flexible?
Yeah, it's like it's top heavy and it doesn't, you know, want to stand up to mm-hmm. the wind, and it's just wimpy.
Okay. First of all, do you know what kind of a tree it is?
A buckeye.
A buckeye has that problem? Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And I've grown them before from the actual nut
mm-hmm.
and planted them, and we were successful. But this particular one, just, I don't know if it's location or...
Okay. Did you purchase this tree from a nursery or something?
No. We grew it from
seed.
Scratch.
Okay. From seed. The only thing I can guess is when that kind of a thing happens, the tree was maybe crowded in its original planting site or the nursery that it was in, and it kind of developed a spindly stem, not a stout stem, and the flexing, the worst thing you could do would be to go ahead and stake it, because that's going to just weaken the strength of the tree altogether. And what it needs to do is, if you want to stake it so that it can be flexible.
Stake it with, like, bungee cords attached
something
like that?
That type of a thing, yes. Uh-huh. So it can go ahead and flex in the wind and uh-huh. not fall over or break off.
How tall is it now, Vicki?
It's actually fairly tall. It's probably 8-10 feet.
Okay. Well, if you went out and got three stakes, where is it you're located? I'm sorry.
Minot.
Oh, Minot. Okay. Well, go to Lowe's Garden Center there, Phil Lowe's place, okay? Mm-hmm. Up there in Minot, and he will have the staking material that you need to have, so you won't injure the tree when you do that. And what it'll do is it'll hold the tree to keep from bending so much that it pulls it out of the ground or snaps it off, but it'll give it a good stability there and allow it to flex. The only way the tree is going to get a stronger trunk is if it has this kind of stress put on it, and it'll develop what's called stress wood, which will help support the top part of the tree.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Makes sense.
Okay, well, hang in there. It Buckeye can come through. I know that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, thanks, Vicki. And you are welcome to call in as well, but we're going to have the news here. So if you want to call in now and get yourself lined up for after the news, you can do that by calling 888-755-6377, or you can write an email to hearitnow, H-E-A-R, hearitnow, at prairiepublic.org. So stick with us, and we'll be back. I know we've got some more questions waiting, and you can get yourself in the queue as well. We'll be back, Ron, right after the news.
You bet.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A top U.S. Department of Energy official says North Dakota could be a model for national energy policy. Dr. Dana Christensen is the Deputy Laboratory Director for Science and Technology. He says North Dakota's energy policy is inclusive, and he says the federal government could take a cue from what the state is doing.
When you look at North Dakota and you can see how the energy policy coupled together with the industry in the state and, in fact, renewing and bringing forward new energies in the state, it's a great template. It's a great blueprint of how we might be able to do this on the national scale.
Phyllis Cotino is the director of the Clean Energy Program for the Pew Environment Group. She says the country could be a world leader in the development of renewable energy, just like North Dakota leads the nation. Both spoke at the Renewable Fuels Action Summit held in Bismarck. The North Dakota Cowboy Hall of Fame has a new leader. The board of directors has named Ray Morrill of Mandan as the new executive director. He succeeds Daryl Dorgan, who retired last fall. Morrill is a charter member of the board of directors. He has stepped down from the board to assume his new duties. Cowboy Hall of Fame showcases North Dakota's Western heritage and cowboy culture. And Williston Mayor Ward Kozer says he would like to see some changes in how oil impact dollars can be spent. Kozer says the oil impact grants can now help out with infrastructure needs, but Williston can't use those dollars for operating expenses. And he says that's a real challenge.
In other words, how do you fund your police department, your fire department, ambulance, all those services? You know, the oil impact grants are designed for infrastructure. And so you really don't have a lot of money to help you pay the extra dollars you have to hire six new policemen this year, a new fireman and ambulance drivers and all those things. So that will be one of the things I already started talking with the governor and the legislature about, is saying, guys, we need to change the formula dollars. The formula has been in place basically the way it is today for many, many years, and times have changed. And so we really need you to look at that.
Kozer says he thinks lawmakers will make some changes to the formula, and he says he's hoping that will mean more money for oil patch communities. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
And I'm Bill Thomas here with Ron Smith on Here It Now. We've got three people lined up on the phone. Let's start with Gary, who's on line two, and he is also on I-94. So be careful, Gary. and he's between Jamestown and Bismarck. What's your question?
It's not a question. I just want to tell you that I was on the internet, and I was, you know, related to the emerging plants.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking, I was having problems with some beans, and I had geese coming out of a slough, and they were eating the bean sprouts. And what I did is I found a company in West Fargo, and it's named Flock Buster. F-L-O-C-K, Buster.
Uh-huh.
And it is a bird repellent, and it's a natural bird repellent. It's got palm oils and different spices, and there's no toxic material in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got taste repellents in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked very, very well with geese on the beans.
Huh.
And I also tried it on some emerging wheat that the geese were coming in, and it worked very well there. So we got a North Dakota product that's you can just find it on the internet, and it's really effective.
Flock Buster in West Fargo.
Right.
All right.
On Main Street. Right on Main Street in West Fargo.
Oh, that is wonderful. Well, thanks, Gary.
Yeah.
That's a great tip. I love learning new things like
think
this.
Think of sometimes I might want to try that
myself. I think their market is started in sunflowers with blackbirds a few years ago, and they're finding other uses for it as they go along. And I think if people looked it up, I think they'd be surprised.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. If we ever get together sometime, I'll buy you a beer or a hamburger or one of both.
A good barley crop, you know.
Right. Won't be treated with any bad chemicals there.
Thanks,
to make
Gary.
It taste bad. Okay, thanks.
Okay,
Blockbuster, that's neat.
And also now on the interstate, if he's still with us, is Tony. He's between Fargo and Bismarck. Hi, Tony, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, go ahead.
Okay, I'm actually on the highway on my way to Montana from Indiana, where I live.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And,
thought I'd take advantage of you guys to define the term for me. I've got arugula in my garden that I planted last year, and it's been a banner year for arugula this year with the very early hot spring we had.
Mm-hmm.
And it came up, and it's self-seeded. It's already, I've already had a crop, and it's already self-seeded a second crop.
Mm-hmm.
The question is this. Is something that self-seeds like that defined as a perennial, or is a perennial only something that comes up from its stock in the ground?
Okay. That's a very good question, Tony. This is really considered an annual, and it's a bolting annual. That term, you might have heard that term sometime, or you will hear it sometime. When the temperature gets high enough, it accelerates the maturation of the plant to go ahead and go from the vegetative state into the reproductive state, which is the seed-producing state. So this is its way of going ahead and perpetuating itself as a species. The perennial plant is one that would be surviving our winter weather and coming back year after year after year. So that original plant that you put in there would still be there 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now. And the world's most famous perennial plant is a peony plant. They many times can outlive the owner of the peony. They plant them. Your grandmother planted them. Your great-grandmother planted them. And you might inherit the family farm that had them, and they're still there. That's the eternal perennial plant. They can last literally forever. So there's your difference between a perennial and an annual. And then there's another one that's called a biennial. Okay? It's vegetative.
Like parsley is that, right?
Yes, exact. Perfect. Yeah, absolute perfect example. Parsley is one of those where it remains vegetative that first year, goes through the winter months, and then it bolts and goes to seed the second year. So you have three different classifications, a perennial, a biennial, and an annual.
So, Tony, is this bolting annual now, is that happening in Indiana or Montana?
No, I'm afraid I'll only be in Montana for a couple of days.
So. Okay, so it's happening back home in Indiana.
This is back home in Indiana.
You must have had some hot weather back there, did you, early on?
We had a very early, very hot spring.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would do it. That and dill. They'll bolt very quickly. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, Marianne.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for the call.
Okay, we've got a caller on the line from Argusville. It is Jason. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Hello. Yes, I have a crab apple tree. It's about 10 years old, and it's been fruiting fairly regularly. This year, I've noticed that I have scratches almost, or cracks in the bark lengthwise along with it. And one of the branches is done, and I can see a couple of the other branches, smaller branches. The leaves are yellowing and the apples are falling off. And I look for information about it. It might be fly or tria. I wanted to get some professional advice.
Well, on your last sentence there, just before you said get some professional advice, you broke up a little bit, so we didn't quite hear the last part. So could you say that again?
Heard it might be either fire blight or nectria, N-E-C-T-R-I-A.
Oh, nectria, yeah, okay, the canker, yeah, okay. All right, so you have a crabapple. You have a crabapple tree, and you see some,
cracks in the bark.
Cracks in the bark, on the main trunk.
The main trunk and along with the other branches of it.
Okay. How do the ends of the branches look? Are they burning up? Are they turning brown? Or they have a shepherd's hook to them? And the leaves remaining on them as they're dead?
Yes, they do kind of bend a little bit.
Okay, then that is a good visible evidence of the symptoms of fire blight. Okay?
All right.
And if you have fire blight on an apple tree, that's usually not a very good sign. Because we have not really had fire blight type weather. When we've run into fire blight weather, it's when we have had a hailstorm or a lot of high winds where you get a lot of breakage taking place on the tissue, and that's followed by high humidity, which usually happens a little bit later on, not typically, but it seems like everything is being accelerated this year. And so you end up with this fire blight hitting the trees, and it's really, really too bad. The best thing to do would be to very carefully on a no wind or a very, very low wind type of day to go in there and cut that branch or branches back as far as you can, and taking a rag or cloth, one that's saturated in alcohol, rubbing alcohol, and wipe your pruning blades clean between each cut, and just simply dispose of those. Get those out of there as much as you possibly can. And then you might want to go ahead and paint. This would be the one time that you'd want to go ahead and paint the wound that you made by with your pruning shear. Go ahead and cover it up with a shellac or typical pruning paint that you could buy at any garden supply store.
Well, okay. Thank you for the information.
Okay, well, good luck to you now. Take care.
Okay. Oh, yeah, the fire blight can be bad. Thanks, mm-hmm. Jason. Mm-hmm. And again, you can call, you can send in questions by emailing to hearitnow, H-E-A-R, hearitnow, at prairiepublic.org, or you can call 888-755-6377. And Larry is on the line from Ross. Larry, go ahead.
Hi, Larry.
Hi. Hi, you guys. I couldn't help but overhearing your problem there with your critters on your plants. We had the same problem in California with sparrows over our church entryway, and we've got a life-size barn owl, a statue of a barn owl, and we had no more problems after that because barn owls will go after small birds, small uh-huh. critters, and small anything else.
Okay.
It might help your listeners out there.
Okay. Well, yeah, thank you very much. Where are you calling from?
Ross.
Okay. Okay, a barn owl statue, okay.
Right. Yeah. Well, they sell those in garden stores, of course.
Yeah,
you see
I guess
them.
So,
yeah. Thanks,
yeah.
Larry.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. These are some good tips.
Well, I did wonder when it first came up about scarecrows mm-hmm. of various sorts, and I've seen people make these things with pie plates and tinsel and stuff that are supposed to flap around and
scare them
away. And I've also seen inflatable snakes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, that does work. Yes. Yeah. Inflatable snakes. They do work. Yeah. That startles them. Yes.
Uh huh. Uh huh. Uh-huh. Will that work on birds too? Do you think?
Yeah. That's they're supposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. That's very good.
Or you could keep a real snake in
there. Yeah.
There,
yeah. Train it. You know. Yeah. Go out there and do your job. You know?
Right. Right.
Scare the birds away.
Go get them.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
A bird-eating snake.
All right. Well, we're getting on through the hour here, but we've got a few more minutes. If you'd like to call in with a question, it's 888-755-6377. And we've got Lillian in Bismarck and Ken in Jamestown,
wow.
or between Jamestown and Bismarck on the line. So let's get those. And then, Ron, you've got something you want to
talk about? Yeah, I'd like to talk about something, too.
Okay, all right. Well, let's do Lillian first. Hi, Lillian. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi. I have quite a few daylilies in my yard,
mm-hmm.
Most of which look very nice this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a few of the plants with some pretty large sections turning yellow,
okay.
most of the leaves turning yellow.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do about that?
Well, it's called by a very imaginative name called yellow streak. Okay? That's a fungus disease that seems to be hitting the daylilies pretty broadly this year. We've not had much of a problem with that in the past. It's just been an occasional thing, but I've gotten a lot of calls on that this year.
Think it's a weather-related?
It could be. It's weather-related, wet spring, overcrowding, daylilies that have not been transplanted or divided for a long time. The best thing to do is remove those yellow leaves as quickly as you can, and you can spray a protective fungicide over the rest of the daylily plants there. I'd suggest putting down some kind of a protective fungicide, something like Heritage or anything that would contain chlorothalonil. There's several of them on the market that would help to protect them.
And so they can keep going. And would it be – now, should you leave them alone, or would this be a good time to split them up and spread
Well,
them
I wouldn't split them while the disease is active. I mean, when I've handled daylilies, it's been in the fall or in the early spring
mm-hmm.
Before they become – these pathogens become active. They're active now, so that would be just be spreading the fire, so to speak.
Yeah, okay.
So,
all right.
So, okay. You get that, Lillian?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're
okay,
welcome.
Thanks.
Take care.
And we've got Ken on the line. He's on the freeway between Jamestown and Bismarck. And Ken, go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great.
I got chokecherries planted in some shelter belts.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed some of my chokecherry bushes are coming up with a black fungus kind of growth on them.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if I have to take those all the way out and destroy them or if it's going to bother the chokecherry production.
If left on
what?
Yeah, left unchecked, it's going to be a problem. If you have it just on one or two trees, I'd go ahead and get those cut out of there and treat it like you would fire blight. It's a very, very contagious disease, a very high contagion. And so it spreads very easily by insects, by birds, by you. You know, if you handle the tree, you brush up against it, it gets carried away by the wind very easily, rain splash. So if you can, get those branches cut them back about 6 inches from the 6 to 8 inches from the visible black knots that you see there, okay?
So take them almost down to the ground, and maybe they'll come back from the root.
Oh, well, if they're that bad, I'd just go ahead and take them out.
Yeah,
because then all you're going to get are a bunch of little suckers coming up, which could still be vulnerable to the that black knot fungus. How many trees are being affected?
Well, I got a number. It's in shelter belt. So I'm noticing that I look in there and there are small choke cherry bushes that are starting to grow, you know.
Yeah.
They're probably 8 foot tall or not too big in diameter. I can take them out with a pruner.
Yeah.
You know? And the other thing is when you're talking to the guy about painting those stubs on the fire blade.
Oh, yes, right.
I had a guy tell me one time to throw some Listerine in my paint. It would help.
Yeah.
Thin the paint out, it would, you know, antiseptic it up.
Yeah, sure will. Yeah, Listerine, good old Lister was quite the scientist back in his day. He introduced the medical world to germs, and so they honored him by naming his famous mouthwash that kills everything in sight.
Yeah, well,
Listerine.
It's not going to hurt the tree to throw the Listerine in the paint, right?
No, uh-uh. It's not going to hurt it.
All right.
Thanks for your call, Ken.
Okay, well, we've got somebody on the line waiting, but let's go ahead. I was really curious about this tree selector thing. If Russ in Ellendale can hold on, Ron wanted to get the word out about tree selector, is that right?
Yeah. My colleague, Dr. Joe Zalesnik, forester in the NDSU Extension Forester, has been working on this for quite some time, and he has 110, which he claims is just the beginning, and he didn't want me to say anything about it, but I'm going to say something about it. And if you want to find out what trees he has selected, trees and shrubs, it's go to ag.nds.edu/TREE-selector, SELECTOR, and there's another backslash. And there's 110 trees and shrubs on there with characteristics and photos and everything else. And it's really beautiful. I just came from a conference where he was showing this off to me. And I said, Joe, why didn't I know about this before? He said, well, I'm not done yet, Ron. I said, well, you can't wait. You can't wait. You know, we need to get this out. There's 110 trees out there that people could know about that they don't know about right now. So, again, that's ag.ndsu.edu/tree-selector/. And I'm sure.
And Skip is going to put the link up if you go to prairiepublic.org to the Hear It Now page. You'll see it there.
So it's a great resource to have for the public to get their hands on. So
okay. So. You're listening to Hear It Now. I'm Bill Thomas, hosting today with Ron Smith, who's talking all about plants. And if Russ has stuck with us in Ellendale, we'll get your question now, Russ.
Hi.
Hi there. I have a question about evergreen trees.
Mm-hmm.
My brother-in-law gave me some trees to transplant, and I put them kind of on the property line, spaced them out accordingly. But they're approximately 10 feet tall now, and I don't want them to get really, really tall. And somebody said if I go up there and nip that top off and leave about 4 inches, that'll stop the growth of the height. Is there anything truth to that?
You know what kind of evergreens they are, first of all, Russ?
Yeah, they're Black Hills.
Oh, Black Hills spruce.
Oh,
great. That's a very good spruce. I'm glad you selected that or you got it rather than the Colorado blue spruce. Yes, that'll help to bush the plant out. It'll force it to have its more lateral growth, and what they call apical dominance will be removed as soon as you take that center growth shoot out. So, yeah,
cut
it right back.
Then and then when it starts to come back, or will it come back, just kind of keep it there. And
yeah.
You can
keep on trimming it every year the way you want, and it'll keep that way. As soon as you give up, then it's going to start to find its own way.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
You bet. problem.
Bye-bye.
And we've still got a little bit of time for more calls. If you want to call 888-755-6377, 888-755-6377, toll free to ask a question for Ron Smith. But, Ron, we got an email question here.
Okay.
Ann in Fargo writes in, I have two Patmore ash trees that have aphids.
Oh, yeah.
The trees have shriveled leaves. There's a white sticky residue falling from the trees. 3 weeks ago, I applied Bayer tree and shrub liquid in the prescribed amount to the ground around the trees.
Okay.
I haven't noticed any difference so far. Should I reapply?
No, don't reapply. You don't want to get into over-toxifying the tree with this toxin. I don't know what the results would be, but if you applied it according to label directions, and that should be based on the caliper size of the tree, you pulled any organic matter or any mulch back from the crown of your tree, from around the base of the tree, and you saw the flare coming out at the trunk of the tree, and you poured it around there, you saturated that area, you should have done it correctly, and it should be on its way up through the vascular system on the way to these little leaf-sucking insects. And so I would say a little bit more patience.
So it takes it a while to get up there.
Oh, yeah, it does. It takes a good while for it to get up there. But I think you will see some results here in another couple of weeks. Once it's in the tree, it's going to be there for the rest of the season, and it'll be there next year as well. So you usually get a couple years benefit out of something like this.
The circulatory system of the trees is not as fast as the human.
No. Okay. It moves along at its own pace.
We've got another caller from Williston. Mm-hmm. It's Melissa on the line. And Melissa, hi. What have you got for us?
Hi, Melissa.
Hi. My question is this. Two things. I missed hearing the total name for that flock protector or something to deal with birds.
Yeah. Flockbuster, wasn't it? We'll have to get up a link about that, too.
Sounds like a TV program. We have the adventures of the Flockbuster.
Well, I'm wondering what it say on there. My issue is geese, but it's geese and they've talked about all these crops, but their crops are on dry ground. Mm-hmm. What about using this on wild rice, ponds?
You know, I can't tell you because I don't know anything about the label. I would suggest contacting them or going online and ask for a label, see what the label would say as far as wild rice goes. So I don't know.
Because the Flockbuster thing works. He said it was oils and different things that made it taste bad.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that seems like it might not work with something that's grown in water.
Yeah.
But
try a couple. Go online and look for this other one. Avipel. Avipel.
I think it's A-L. A-V-I-P-A-L.
A-L, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, A-V-I-P-A-L. Avipel. Okay.
And Melissa, and for other people who are listening, we'll have this information up on the Hear It Now page. So
okay, the other question, if you guys could answer, is how late in the season after lilacs bloom can you cut them back? I know you should do it fairly soon after they bloom because they tend to grow their pods for next year for flowering, but I'm wondering how far you can go into cutting them back before you're destroying
it's too late.
Next year's.
Well, I would say this would be a good weekend coming up to go ahead and get that task out of the way.
Okay.
Okay? And that way you'd be absolutely safe because everything seems to be accelerating. And in the old days, not that far ago, not that long ago, I should say, we'd say no later than August 1st. But with the way everything is accelerating, Bill, I would say let's just push it up to July 1st and say be on the safe side.
I usually do it within a week or at the most two afterwards, but I got kind of sidetracked with other projects.
Yeah, that's easily done. Don't worry. Yeah. I'm the same way.
So, okay, well, great. I will do that, and I'll look up that Avipel and Flockbuster.
Okay, and it'll be on our website.
Okay, and that's the... Okay, I've got it up, I think.
PrairiePublic.org. We'll get it up there. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
All right, we'll have that up soon. Okay, well, thanks a lot. Well, Ron, we're out of time. We had a lot of calls today.
Boy, I can't believe it. It's like, well, where did all these people come from?
I even had some questions I was saving up, and I didn't get to ask them. So, maybe they'll still be good next time.
Okay.
You've been listening to Ron Smith, and Ron is NDSU Extension horticulturist. He has a great online newsletter called Hortoscope, and we'll be back with more on Hear It Now. We've got Dakota Datebook coming next.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Attorney Daniel Buchanan of Buchanan Law Office in Jamestown.
specializing in elder law and estate planning. Information on these and other legal matters is available at 252-6604.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 25th. Alexander McKenzie was a political boss in North Dakota's early years. He was part of a political machine and had many interests in the state, often shady ones, even after he moved away. In June of 1922, while involved in a civil suit in Minnesota, McKenzie started to feel ill. He told friends he just had a touch of the flu, but within 24 hours, he was failing fast. On June 22nd, McKenzie died in St. Paul, much to the surprise of residents in Bismarck. McKenzie had been in fairly good health, and he had been expected to be in town that week. People began to remember him for his generosity and his involvement in the state's development. Judge George T. Flannery of St. Paul, who knew McKenzie from his first days in Bismarck, declared that he was absolutely without fear and that his remarkable strength of character and indomitable goodwill stood him in good stead in the turbulent days on the frontier. After the report of his death, residents in Bismarck successfully lobbied for McKenzie's body to be returned to the state. They wanted to bury him in the city. So on this date, his body returned to his old home of Bismarck, accompanied by two daughters, a son-in-law, and by his old friends, Captain I.P. Baker and Colonel C.B. Little. McKenzie was laid in state in the old Capitol building. That building had once been the territorial capital, which McKenzie had helped to move to Bismarck. Flags throughout the city were sailed at half-mast. It was estimated that more than 2,000 people visited the body. The Bismarck Tribune reported, as the body lay in a massive walnut coffin before the rostrum of the House of Representatives, a silent line of men, women, and children passed to view the face of the deceased. Four uniformed men stood as guards at the coffin, while others, scattered about the House chamber, directed the lines of people with a wave of a hand. The funeral probably was the largest public funeral tribute ever paid in the state. Beside the glass-covered casket, passed with bared heads, many whose gray hair and bronzed faces testified to their right to be called pioneers of the state. Others, younger, passed who perhaps only were curious to gaze upon the face of one of whom they heard their fathers and mothers speak with awe. Former political associates and political foes alike were there. McKenzie was buried in St. Mary's Cemetery. Some of his papers and correspondence reside today at the State Archives of North Dakota. His memory and his work and his influence, good and the bad alike, live on. Dakota Datebook is a production of Prairie Public in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, funded by the North Dakota Humanities Council. For more information or to listen anytime, go to prairiepublic.org. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
I'm Bill Thomas. Tomorrow on Hear It Now, Laura Ingalls Wilder. Well, Laura is not around anymore, but of course her Little House on the Prairie books have been read by so many people, made such an impression on Kelly Kathleen Ferguson that she dressed up in pioneer clothes and retraced the journey all the way to South Dakota, to Missouri. She was an Ohio University doctoral student in creative nonfiction. We've got an interview with her tomorrow. Discussion of movies with Matt O'Lean, Tom Eastern with Plains Folk, all tomorrow on Hear It Now. Meanwhile, stay tuned for more great programming on Prairie Public. I'm Bill Thomas.